Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, developments in the dialogue between Catholics and Anglicans can provide valuable insights to both churches, according to the archbishops who co-chaired a recent meeting in Hong Kong. Building on Nostra Aetate, the landmark document which dramatically changed the Catholic Church's relationship with the Jews. And Silence and Word. We take a look at the theme for this Sunday's World Communications Day. The Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, or ARCIC 3, recently concluded a week-long meeting hosted by the Anglican Mission to Seafarers in Hong Kong. At the end of the May 4th to 10th meeting, the two teams of theologians and church leaders issued a joint statement, saying ARCIC has carried forward considerably its work in response to the mandate given it by the Catholic Church and the Anglican Communion. It has also sharpened its focus in terms of the two questions of communion and ethical decision-making. The communique stresses that participants are very keen to promote the reception of ARCIC work, and so they intend to contact national groups of Anglicans and Catholics to share with them the work of the Commission and to hear their ideas about practical ecumenism on the ground. The Commission also invited an outside observer from the Greek Catholic Church, who greatly helped with his contribution on the broader aspects of understanding the Church as communion. The invitation to the Very Reverend Peter Galadze, a married Ukrainian Catholic priest from the Sheptytsky Institute of Eastern Christian Studies in Ottawa, Canada, marked the first time ARCIC has sought experience from outside its mandate to deepen its understanding of the concept of Catholicity. I spoke to Catholic Archbishop Bernard Longley of Birmingham and Anglican Archbishop David Moxon of New Zealand, the two co-chairs of the meeting, to find out more. Archbishop Bernard Longley, the last time we spoke here in Rome, you were optimistic about building on the results of the last ARCIC meeting that took place here in Bose in northern Italy. What can you tell us about the results of this second session of the ARCIC talks?
I think our expectations, or rather our hopes, at the end of the first session certainly have, in a large part, have been fulfilled, that this session has given us an opportunity to deepen the dialogue. I think it has strengthened the atmosphere of dialogue in which we've been working and certainly helped us to extend our understanding. And in particular, because we have, I think, this time had to give less time to thinking about our methodology, how we would proceed, and to building relationships, and we've been able actually to devote much more time to the issues themselves. And a solid part of our work together has been reflecting upon the issues which have been part of the mandate from our respective churches. And so that was our hope, and I think it has been fulfilled in the very encouraging and helpful atmosphere of the Mission to Seafarers here in Hong Kong.
The two questions you were looking at specifically were the relationship of the local church to the global church and this question of ethical decision-making. What insights can you share with us, if you like, from your discussions around these two crucial issues?
Those are the two central issues, as you've outlined them. There are some additional tasks that we've been given, and very importantly there, the reception of the documents of ARCIC 2. But the method of approaching these two central tasks, I say we've begun to get to grips with the material, some of which is the result of assignments to our members over the last year. So we've been, as it were, harvesting the fruits of their work over this last 12 months. Much of that material was passed to the members of the Commission before we came together to work, and I would say it has really deepened our understanding of the experience that we have within each of our communions of what it means to be both local and universal and worldwide. In fact, we've been looking in rather more detail at what it means to be Catholic in relation to the scope in time and across the world as a communion. On the second issue, in fact, today we're in the middle, the very middle of our reflection on a series of case studies. But I think maybe if I don't say too much about that second part of our work, and you may want to refer that to my co-chairman, Archbishop David.
Going back to that first question then, this question of local and universal or worldwide, as you put it, I mean, we're marking the 50th anniversary of Vatican II, and this question of authority, of collegiality, of the relationship of the bishops to the Pope still seem to be at the heart of difficulties within the Catholic Church. In fact, have even come more to the fore recently, I would say. What can you share with us from your meeting there about perhaps ways of resolving these tensions between Rome and the local bishops' conferences?
We've begun to look together, in fact, at certainly looking very carefully at within the different provinces of the Anglican Communion, the methods of involvement within church governance. But also we've been looking at the synodality within both traditions. And as we prepare for the Year of Faith, which Pope Benedict announced last year, and the Synod of Bishops, the General Synod of Bishops, which will be on the new evangelization, the scope of synodality for Catholic bishops and the way in which that has been used is something that we've been reflecting on together. So I think actually within the context of our own discussions, greater clarity and something of a history as well of the use of the Synod of Bishops within the Catholic Church and the relationship, the place of the Bishop of Rome within the Synod of Bishops, the relationship with his own teaching office, and that sense that is always there of Peter and the 12 being together. So there has been an opportunity to reflect on that in a way which I think has been beneficial, helpful for the Catholic members of our group as well.
You rightly mentioned the upcoming Year of Faith, the Synod on New Evangelization to take place in October. And of course, ecumenism will be a very significant part of that synod, won't it? Especially in the English context.
That's right. I'm certain that the understanding of evangelization and the new evangelization, I think it's a degree, it's a mark of the degree to which we are committed at all levels within our churches to engaging together, that it would be unthinkable for us to consider evangelization without also considering the experience of our sister churches. And of course, the opportunity for ecumenical participation is built into the structures of the Synod of Bishops. So that's going to be an important dimension of it, I'm certain. What we can learn from the experience of other communions is they approach the very same issues in many of the areas where we're both together.
Archbishop David Moxon, the last time we spoke in the wake of the first archic meeting in Bose here in northern Italy, you talked to me about unexpected outcomes, positive breakthroughs in the talks. How much have you been able to build on that in a concrete way in this meeting in Hong Kong?
Very much so. In fact, I think the enthusiasm and momentum of that first meeting in Bose near Milan has continued. After a year of interim work, we reconvened again for the first time here in Hong Kong, and I noticed within 24 hours that the same spirit and the same positivity, the same potential was already present. And in fact, we've just finished a session this afternoon, which I think will turn out to be very interesting for the churches at large, not only for people who are interested in Anglican, Roman Catholic ecumenism, but also people who are interested in the topics that we're working on.
The topics around the question of ethical decision-making, which is part of the mandate, isn't it, of this session?
Very much so. And we've decided to look in three areas, which we will work on in the next 12 months, how our respective churches have made or are making moral decisions and what methodologies we respectively use. In areas where we might expect to have common agreement at the moment, for example, on slavery, areas where we are still not settled between ourselves, around divorce, for example, contraception, remarriage, and areas where we've got a lot of work to do together with other churches, like nation building, the common good, a theology of work. And so the two churches will be applying their own methodologies, explaining them to each other, and I think that will assist people everywhere in the Christian world who want to use good principles for making moral decisions and ethical decisions in the light of the Christian gospel. I think we'll be offering a resource that will go way beyond the ecumenical world.
You're meeting there in the Anglican Seafarers Mission in Hong Kong, aren't you? Why the choice of this location, and how important is that to the talks that are going on?
It's very important. The chapel here is an Anglican Roman Catholic chapel with one altar. The Anglican Holy Communion, the Roman Catholic Mass, celebrated at different times each week in this one building, where they minister to Roman Catholic, Anglican, and all other Protestant denominations who come through the port of Hong Kong. So we've been sharing our Vespers, our respective Eucharists and Masses, in the same chapel of St. Peter. St. Peter, of course, a resonance for the Catholic Church, but also for the sea. And it's been a very important venue to be in because we've heard of the work of ministry to migrants and also domestic workers in Hong Kong from an Anglican and a Roman Catholic point of view. Both churches have their sleeves rolled up. Both churches are actively pursuing ministry to these people who are at serious disadvantage, both in terms of immigration and in terms of the nature of their domestic work. So that was, again, another ecumenical strand, and it couldn't have been a better venue in that sense. This time, the Anglicans were the host, obviously, and Boze, the Catholics were. And although it's very different than Boze, which was a monastery, this is a seafarer's mission, there's still the same sense of the context encouraging us and influencing us.
You also met, didn't you, with seminarians there, Chinese seminarians, who will be the next generation of those ministering within the two churches. How important was that, do you think, as a part of this meeting?
Well, that turned out to be a very good example of what ARCHIC is on about in practice. Because the two seminaries, the Roman Catholic Seminary of the Holy Spirit and the Theological College of Minghua, the Anglican Theological College, as you say, sent their students to be with us last night, and they admitted when they were with us that they have never formally talked to each other before in Hong Kong. Last night they did, because ARCHIC was present and we co-hosted, Bernard and I, a discussion between them and between ourselves. And they said at the end of the evening, they must talk formally with each other now. So that's precisely an example of what ARCHIC is all about, receptive ecumenism on the ground and increasing rapport and interdependence on the ground.
My thanks there to Anglican Archbishop David Moxon of New Zealand and Catholic Archbishop Bernard Longley of Birmingham, the two co-chairs of the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, which recently concluded a week of work in Hong Kong. Cardinal Kurt Koch, who heads the Vatican's Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews, gave a lecture on Wednesday at Rome's Pontifical Angelicum University on the past 50 years of Christian-Jewish dialogue since the Second Vatican Council. The lecture, organised by the university's John Paul II Centre for Interreligious Dialogue and the Russell Berry Foundation, was entitled Building on Nostra Aetate, the landmark declaration which marks the Magna Carta of the Church's relationship to the Jewish people. In his talk, the Swiss cardinal reviewed the developments that have taken place since then and explored some open theological questions in the dialogue between the two faiths. I sat down with Cardinal Kurt Koch to talk about the importance of Nostra Aetate and the dramatic changes it ushered in the wake of Vatican II. Cardinal Koch, you're speaking on this question, building on Nostra Aetate, 50 years on. Is it, in your view, possible to say that Nostra Aetate and the Church's change in attitude towards the Jewish world is perhaps one of the most significant developments of Vatican II?
Is one of the most important developments after the Second Vatican Council. But there are others, the ecumenism, the declaration of the religious liberty and other things. But I think that Nostra Aetate has changed the attitude of the Catholic Church in front of the Jews, of the Judaism. And there are many, many developments in these 50 years with very good situation for the relationship that we have today.
You're also pointing out that reflecting on the Catholic Church's relationship with the Jewish world is a theme that runs through other documents of Vatican II besides Nostra Aetate.
It's the joint of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion for the Religious Relation with the Jews. This commission has published three documents for deepening the Nostra Aetate, for implanting Nostra Aetate in the church, in the diocese, and a declaration about the Holocaust, we remember, and as mentioned, the document of the Bible Commission of the Vatican about the Jewish people and his book, his holy book, in the New Testament. This was a very, very important work in the last years and is very important for the dialogue in the future.
The question of how much Christian anti-Semitism was responsible for the Shoah, it remains a difficult question, doesn't it? You mentioned the document We Remember. Have there been, do you think, very significant developments since then on this issue?
It's very clear that the anti-Semitism of the National-Socialism wasn't a Christian anti-Semitism, was a pagan attitude, a horrible pagan attitude. But the Catholic Church and the Christianity in Europe and in the world must have the question that I have contribute in the history to development of an anti-Judaism. That's a difference. And I think that also today we have tendencies of anti-Judaism, not only in the traditionalist sphere, but also in the progressist, liberal sphere, when they make a clear difference between the labor attitude of the Judaism and the liberty of Christianity. We have some things, we have many attention of these tendencies.
Do you think the Church should therefore be doing more, should be more concerned about this, these new forms, perhaps, of anti-Semitism?
I think that's duty in the diverse regional and national situation of the churches. The bishops and the bishop conferences must be attentive to these tendencies. Here on the level of the universal church, we can only remember the duty of these tendencies.
At the theological level, you're also talking about the many improvements in the dialogue, but this question of the Church's mission of evangelization to the Jewish world, as you say, remains a very sensitive one, and news tensions again have resurfaced here, haven't they?
That's a very, very difficult question that we cannot answer in two sentences. Because firstly, it is need to make a difference between mission and give witness of the Christian faith. It's clear that the Christians want to give witness of faith everywhere. But the Catholic Church doesn't have a clear mission in front of the Jews, because they are convinced that the Judaism is an important issue in the history of salvation, and that the covenant that God have closed with this people is today valid and is not a thing of the past. But secondly, the The most important question is the relationship between the Old and the New Testament. The New Testament have its roots in the Old Testament, and the New Testament must have a great respect in the view of the Old Testament. But on the other side, the New Testament have a new message. And how these two sides are in harmony, that's the very important question. And this is need to deepen this question in the conversation with the Jews.
You're travelling to Israel, aren't you, to meet with Jewish leaders there. What will be the focus of your discussions there?
This is need to deepen the relation with the chief rabbis in Jerusalem. There are just relations of many years, and is needed to have the personal relation, the personal contact with these responsibilities of the Jews people in Israel.
My thanks there to Cardinal Kurt Koch, head of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity and of the Vatican's Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews. Silence and Word, a Path of Evangelization. That's the theme for this year's World Communications Day, celebrated each year by the Church on May the 20th. The message from the Pope for this occasion was released earlier in January on the feast of St. Francis de Sales, patron saint of Catholic journalists. In the message, the value of silence is presented not as a simple antidote to the constant flow of information which characterizes today's world, but rather as an essential tool to help us understand and welcome the Word of God into our lives. I talked about these ideas with Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary of the Vatican's Council for Social Communications, which publishes the annual message.
I think what the Pope's message this year has very fortunately touched into something that a lot of people are thinking about and reflecting about, not just people of faith. The Pope is saying that silence is important for communications, not that silence is a refusal of communications or even a refusal of the new technologies. What he's saying is, though, that good communication, good human communication, always required silence. I have to listen to the other person. In fact, my silence may be that which enables the other person to speak. Silence itself can be eloquent. One thinks of many times when the best thing you can do is be present and be silent rather than risking the wrong words. So I think that anthropological or human dimension of silence, the Pope has touched into something that other people are thinking about and reflecting about as well. The other thing about silence is, if I'm being bombarded with information and news and opinions and ideas, and I feel I have to engage immediately with that, the danger is I don't actually take the time to analyse, reflect, think about, and engage critically with all this material. And I think silence is a presupposition. If I'm going to be actually the one who is maybe, I don't want to say controlling, but the person who is directing my own communication rather than the person who's been forced into certain ideas and arenas without thinking it through. So in order to have a real quality of conversation rather than simply a quantity of conversation, we need to create that space and time for people to reflect critically, and silence is a presupposition for that. I think the other area that the Pope is very clearly opening up as a thing is that within the faith, within our Catholic faith tradition, but within also the faith traditions of other great world religions, the importance of silence and the importance of solitude, that I create space and time that allows me to hear the gentle voice of God among all the more shouting that I engage with in the public arena, that I need to create the space where I can listen to and hear that gentle word of God, which is necessary for us.
It's a difficult message to get across, isn't it? Particularly to the young generation, who are more focused, less focused on solitude and more on friends and, as you say, this constant quality, quantity of communication.
I think there's two ways of seeing it. The desire of young people for constant communication and connectivity is itself saying that human nature has not changed. That fundamentally young people, no more than their parents before them, are searching for some sense of relationship. They want to feel that they're valued and they're cared for, and that they have the capacity to show their love and care for other people. What we, I think, want to do is invite them to see a richer idea of this, because there can be a vulnerability. I know many parents are talking to parents very often, that concern they have about sons and daughters who are constantly engaged, who are afraid somehow to switch off, who feel that if somehow they're not communicating, that they're not existing. And we want to deepen that and say, look, one of the ways in which we discover the truth of who we are is through our relationships with other people. But that also we need to be able to discover ourselves, learn who we are in the middle of that, and that that requires silence. So I think there's a countercultural element in what we're trying to say. But I think when people are in a safe environment, exposed to the possibility of silence and reflection and thinking, that that too will engage them. And one of the things that is interesting is that doesn't mean going offline. Online, we have all sorts of resources, sites that enable people quietly to learn meditation or to learn how to reflect and think about the gospel, or that oblige them somehow to stop and think about what they're doing. So I think we need to engage all of those resources, knowing that in inviting people to silence and to solitude, we're actually leading them into something that they will actually enjoy when they get the chance to experience it. One of the things I've learned about this recently is a friend of mine who's involved in a secondary school in Ireland has been bringing kids away on retreat for years. And one of the things over the last few years he's been trying to do is say, look, don't take your cell phones, don't bring, you know, your personal computers, we want this to be silent. And it didn't work. And this year he took them to a place at the Wicklow Mountains, very close to Glendalough near Dublin, where by chance there was no signal. And he said for the first few hours there was crazy panic as people were beginning to climb up the hill to try and get some signal. But gradually, and it wasn't that he had imposed this, he was delighted, but he hadn't chosen this deliberately, but gradually they found that by the end of the few days, many of them said, you know, the most interesting thing like this was about learning how, at first being frightened by being cut off from all my usual connectivity, but after a while realising that suddenly I was engaging more with the other people who were here, and suddenly that I had time for myself and time to think. Now, I'm not saying they all converted immediately, but maybe we need to offer people that experience to realise that sometimes it's taking time off from something that we remember how blessed and how important it is.
My thanks there to Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.